This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Some interviews drive by, others stay for the deep record. This week I have two heavy hitters for you. Right out of the international news, forest fires near the Chernobyl nuclear wreck in Ukraine have raised dangerous radioactive particles into the atmosphere again. We have Dr. Timothy Musso, the world's foremost expert on the impacts of Chernobyl and Fukushima radiation on living things. Then Utah scientist Tim Garrett updates his work, showing only a collapse of civilization could prevent terrible climate change. There are new discoveries about our utter dependence on fossil energy and where that leads. This is Radio EcoShock. Let's get busy. The largest fire in 20 years is burning near the crippled Chernobyl nuclear plant. The smoke will re-release radioactive contamination dropped in the forests during the 1986 meltdown of reactor number 4, possibly the world's worst nuclear disaster. How can radiation remain and return? Scientists have been hard at work studying that problem. Just this February, the journal Ecological Monographs published a paper titled Fire Evolution in the Radioactive Forests of Ukraine and Belarus, Future Risks to the Population and the Environment. Dr. Timothy A. Musso is a co-author of that paper. Tim is a professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina. He joins us now. Dr. Musso, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
How long have you been studying the biological after effects of Chernobyl radiation?
Well, we first got started in Chernobyl in the summer of 2000, actually, and we've been visiting the site four times every year since.
All right. Now, we've been told nature has returned to the closed zone around the plant and everything is thriving. Is that true?
Well, it's like so many of these statements, it's part true and part false. It is true that nature has come back to some extent, and certainly there are plants and animals living in the areas around the nuclear reactor. There are even some living in the most contaminated parts of the exclusion zone. But what the real question should be is there an impact of the radioactivity of these animals and plants that are living in this area? And that's really the question that we've tried to focus on for the past 15 years or so.
Now, what general areas did the radiation settle in as far as forests are concerned?
Well, you know, the fire, you know, it was a nuclear fire that burned for 10 days, and it was basically, you can liken it to a volcano emitting these radioactive isotopes into the atmosphere. So depending on which way the wind was blowing and whether it was raining or not, the fallout dropped all over the area. The highest, you know, the areas of highest contamination are within a couple hundred kilometers of the actual reactor, but it actually was dispersed across Scandinavia and as well as into Central and Western Europe. And, of course, it's detectable around the Northern Hemisphere. If you take a core from the ocean anywhere just about in the Northern Hemisphere, you'll find traces of the Chernobyl event in the sediments that were deposited. So it really had a nearly global impact in terms of the dispersion of the radioactivity. But the highest levels are found within 50 to a couple hundred kilometers of the actual reactor.
And how does this work? Does radiation just stay in the soil, or do the trees and other plants take it up into their parts?
Yeah, well, you know, the dominant isotope in Chernobyl and Fukushima, for that matter, is cesium-137. And cesium-137 is, you know, a potassium analog. It behaves chemically much like potassium does. And so the plants actually mistake it, confuse it for potassium, and take it up as if they were taking up potassium. So this potassium, this cesium gets taken up by the plants in the water, transferred to the leaves and through the tissues. And so it gets moved around. Even though most of the fallout is in the soil, it gets taken up in the water through the plant root system up into the leaves and then redeposited onto the surface soil, every year as the plants, you know, drop their leaves, usually during the fall.
How serious are the fires now near Chernobyl at the end of April 2015?
So luckily it sounds like they've got the fires under control, but clearly the estimates are from a few hundred acres to a few thousand acres of forest have been burned. Some of these fires are in areas of relatively high contamination. Luckily, much of the area burned is just happens by chance to be in an area that has relatively low contamination. So hopefully they've managed to put it out before it got to the hottest areas where the greatest hazards would be from the redispersal of the radionuclides.
Have there been fires in the neighboring country of Belarus, and is that important?
There have been fires throughout the area. In fact, we were just looking at a recent satellite photo showing that there have been many dozens of fires, most of them quite small, throughout Ukraine and Belarus and parts of southwestern Russia as well. And all of these areas have significant land mass contaminated by Chernobyl, and as such are potentially hazardous with respect to forest fires redispersing the contaminants. So it's an ongoing condition. It's likely to get worse in the future as global climate change raises the average temperatures and reduces the total amount of precipitation in the area as well.
And you were part of a team of scientists, Timothy Musso, who studied exactly this risk. What did you conclude?
Yeah, the team is a large team, a multinational team from many countries who got together to examine the past records of forest fires and to make use of what we know of the original incident where the radionuclides were dispersed from the reactor as it melted down, put those two together, combine it with the current trends in climate change, increasing temperatures and precipitation patterns, and reduced precipitation in many of these areas, put that all together into a simulation model, and what we basically demonstrate is that there's an enormous potential hazard from these forest fires because of the fact that they're likely to increase in size and intensity, and this has the power to lift the radioactive contaminants from the soil, from the plant material, and put it into the atmosphere and redistribute it.
Now, what kind of radiation are we talking about? Are there other elements and isotopes beyond cesium-137 that get out in that fire smoke?
Absolutely. And the current concern is, of course, that several of these other isotopes are potentially far more dangerous biologically than the cesium-137. We tend to focus on the cesium because it's easy to measure. We can measure it with a gamma counter, with a simple Geiger counter, in fact, whereas some of the other isotopes, like strontium-90, which is really there at about equal levels to the cesium, the strontium-90, because it's a beta emitter, it doesn't give off any gamma. This makes it much, much harder to measure its levels, and so people tend not to bother to measure it and simply to assume that it's going to move along with the cesium. But the strontium is a calcium analog, and so it gets taken up the same way into plants and animals the way that the calcium would, and as a consequence it tends to be fixed into the teeth and into the bones, and it can actually bioaccumulate and biomagnify up the food chain to a much greater level than cesium usually does. So this makes it even a more hazardous isotope. It tends to, again, be in the background because we can't measure it very easily. There are other isotopes. There's a significant amount of plutonium in the ground deposited around the reactor. This plutonium is also decaying into something called americium, and americium and plutonium are extremely dangerous if ingested. The dangers are well known and never a threat. They're heavier, they're denser, and they're less likely to be mobilized, but they are going to be mobilized if the fire is large enough. And, of course, the half-lives for the plutonium isotopes are measured in the tens of thousands of years for the most part, and the americium is in hundreds of years. So, in fact, the americium levels are increasing in the area as a result of the decay of the plutonium. And so, the hazards are actually going to increase over the coming decades with respect to those isotopes.
And I'm presuming there are health risks to humans who would breathe this forest fire smoke?
Absolutely, and the biggest risks, the biggest hazards are for the firefighters who have to go in and put these fires out as quickly as they can. There's really no way, you know, for them to protect themselves from much of the exposure. They do wear masks and gloves, and so hopefully that minimizes their exposure. But just being there, breathing that air, means that they're going to be getting a significant dose as a result. Luckily, the further away you are from the source, the more diluted the isotopes become, and the hazards related to direct exposure to humans decrease fairly quickly as you get further from these fires. But the problem is that it's not really the external dose that we're most concerned about in many cases. The cesium, for instance, gets taken up by plants differentially. Some, and mushrooms, of course, are a major user of cesium in the soil. Again, they concentrate it to such an extent in their tissues that animals who feed on mushrooms, for instance, the wild boar and the mice and a few other things, they end up with levels of radioactivity inside their bodies that exceed safe levels for human consumption. Even in Germany, as far away as Germany, many of the wild boar cannot be eaten because of the high levels of cesium in their bodies. And we're of course presuming that some of the other isotopes are concentrated to a similar extent.
Now, what about the impacts on creatures like birds and insects? I think you've done some study on that. Could you take a little time and tell us what you and other scientists have learned?
Yeah, we've been working with the birds primarily since 2000, Anders Moller and I together, and as well as many other individuals who've joined our team in subsequent years. And we've been finding all sorts of very unexpected consequences for the animals and plants living in these contaminated areas. The most striking findings we've reported in many different places over the years concern impacts on the abundance of various species. We found repeatedly for many species in both Chernobyl and Fukushima now that the numbers of birds drops off in the more contaminated areas. There's a really nice dose-response relationship, as it were, with many fewer of these birds in highly radioactive areas. We've subsequently, documented many potential mechanisms underlying these declines. Some of the more striking ones are the fact that in Chernobyl, at least, we see that up to 40% of the male birds are completely sterile. They have no sperm in the more radioactive areas. But we see many other more subtle effects, like the fact that, again, birds in more contaminated areas have more higher incidences of cataracts, they have higher incidences of tumors, and other developmental abnormalities that clearly would influence their ability to survive and reproduce. And of course, we're assuming that these are the underlying causal factors related to the population declines. In the last couple of years, we've started some new work with small rodents, mice and voles, both in Chernobyl and Fukushima, where we're trying to, repeat the studies that we've done in Chernobyl, and we're finding very similar patterns of decline and similar patterns of increased numbers of tumors and cataracts and other developmental abnormalities that are just rarely seen in sort of normal populations anywhere else.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Professor Tim Mousseau, an internationally recognized expert on the effect of radiation on living things. Tim, it's my understanding that some radiation is so long-lived it never goes away on a human timescale, let's say. Will radiation lifted by the current fires in the Ukraine just settle somewhere else to be a risk again and again?
Many of these elements, these radioactive isotopes, will eventually disappear. The half-life for cesium-137 is about 30 years, and for strontium-90 is about 29 years. And so certainly after a century or two, most of that will have decayed into either less radioactive or non-radioactive daughter products. But certainly we have, a century or two to deal with it. Some of the other isotopes I mentioned earlier, the plutonium isotopes and the americium, will be around for hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of years, just because they take much longer to decay into less dangerous daughter products. So it's an ongoing issue that's not going to disappear anytime soon. you know, I should mention that, you know, one of our primary interests and one of the, actually the main motivation for the research we've been doing in these areas wasn't so much to document, you know, all of these abnormal or these negative consequences of exposure to radioactivity, but in fact, to determine whether or not there have been, you know, adaptive evolutionary responses of the organisms to this novel stressor. And so we've actually devoted some energy to understanding how populations might respond in a more positive way. And just recently, again, we published a paper last year demonstrating that, you know, a handful of birds, just a few of them, but a significant number, have actually managed to cope with the radiation in a way that was really quite striking. And they do this by changing the allocation of some of their antioxidants towards defense against the radiation. Now, it's not all rosy because this change in allocation probably incurs a cost in terms of, you know, they can't use that antioxidant for some other important function, but it certainly gives them an advantage when living in these radioactive areas. And that really is, you know, our hope is to better understand how these organisms respond and adjust and adapt and whether or not they can and what the underlying mechanisms are for that variability. Again, with the hope that such an understanding may help deal with, you know, the human populations or help address some of the problems that the human populations are facing in response to these contaminants as well.
That is fascinating and important work, I think. Now, as you know, Tim, the reactor site at Chernobyl is still not very safe. There's a temporary sarcophagus hastily thrown over it, and now part of a shell meant to confine further emissions is not completed almost 30 years after the meltdown. Why has it taken so long, and what is the holdup now?
Well, the main reason that it's taken so long is that it's incredibly expensive. It's you know, costing on the order of $2 billion to build this new shelter for the old reactor site. Without this new shelter, they really can't get started at a more permanent remediation of the area. They really need to dry it out and contain whatever dust and debris is contained inside the old reactor that you know could be released if the old shelter were to collapse in some way. But it's mainly a financial issue, as is often the case. $2 billion for a country like Ukraine is an enormous amount of money, and luckily the world community has stepped up to, you know, help fund the better part of this endeavor. Yeah, there's been recent meetings again to try to raise the remaining, you know, $500 million plus or minus that's needed to complete the project. Of course, that's just the beginning. That's just the first step in this process. Once they get this new roof in place, then they'll be able to hopefully develop ways to actually investigate the interior of the building, which has not been done to this point because it's so highly radioactive that, you know, people still cannot get into the lower reaches of the old reactor where most of the spent fuel has found itself. And so, of course, it's also a very wet area at the moment because the roof was leaking. Water has filled the bottom, and so this makes it impossible for people or machines to investigate, you know, what's happened down there. So hopefully there will be ongoing investment by the international community to help solve this problem. But it does point to the sort of the broader inclusive costs of these kinds of disasters. You know, the disaster in Fukushima will end up being far more expensive because it's a much larger accident in many ways, and it's in a highly developed country. So, hopefully we'll make some progress in the coming years to solve these problems.
Tim, you are going right back to the Ukraine. Is it a bit chaotic there, and what will you be doing?
Yeah, things are very unstable at the moment in Ukraine, given the ongoing conflict between Ukraine and Russia over the eastern territories. And of course, this has had an enormous impact on their economy. And, you know, their currency has been devalued considerably by several factors in the past few years, certainly mostly the past few months. And the unemployment rates have gone through the roof. And so it's not a happy place to be visiting. We're hoping to continue our ongoing studies of the of the rodents living in the area, as well as studies of some of the other organisms like the endangered Chevalsky's horses that were introduced to the area that really haven't been monitored intensively since their introduction. So, yeah, the plan is to keep going, and we're also hoping to repeat some of our earlier surveys of distribution and abundance of many of the species later this year, probably in June.
Will you be continuing your research on the blown reactors in Fukushima, Japan, the impact on living things there as well?
Yeah, we have a parallel set of research studies going on in Japan at the moment, somewhat smaller scale because of lack of funding at the moment, but we're continuing to monitor the bird populations. We just published three papers in the past month or so documenting how the bird populations have been affected by the Fukushima disaster. The bottom line is that many of the bird species are showing very dramatic declines in the areas of high radioactivity. What makes that particularly interesting, of course, is that it parallels what we've been finding in Chernobyl in a completely independent area. Again, providing fairly strong scientific support for the hypothesis that it's the radioactivity that's the underlying cause of these drops in numbers. So we're hoping to continue and repeat many of the Chernobyl studies in Japan, again, with the aim of determining whether or not we see the same kinds of patterns, which in all likelihood could only be explained by the radiation rather than any other potentially confounding factor.
Now, what about the contentious issue of the impact of low-level radiation? Every time there's a major accident, the nuclear industry says eating a banana or flying in a plane is more dangerous. Is low-level radiation dangerous?
So, you know, the bottom line to all this discussion is that all radiation of all sorts generates damage to our cellular structures. It leads to damage to our DNA, damage to the membranes around the nucleus of our cells and the cell walls themselves. Our bodies have evolved mechanisms to repair most of this damage over the eons. Radiation isn't new. Mutagens in the environment aren't new. And in fact, the very oxygen we breathe is a major cause of mutations in our bodies. And so we have all the machinery in place to deal with it, at least to some extent. But the fact that we grow old and die is actually in part the product of ongoing mutational accumulation through our lives. So radiation of all sorts, even small amounts, contributes to that. And so there's no such thing as a little bit of radiation being good for you. It may not be detectable in its effects because it's small relative to the other mutagens in our environment. But the more you add, the more the effects will be. And that's really what's going on. So, you know, one airplane ride is unlikely to be of much significance given that we expose ourselves to many other mutagens in the environment. The same could be said for, you know, eating one banana. But if you fly an awful lot, then you will be increasing the dose to your body. And this has been demonstrated to lead to increased rates of cataracts, for instance, in airline crews, which is one of the first signs of radiation exposure. We see it in the birds. We see it in humans as well. And certainly, it's just the first step. There are other consequences likely. We also did a study not too long ago, a survey of the literature and a meta-analysis of other people's data, in addition to our own, of human and plants and animals living in naturally radioactive areas of the world. You know, there are many parts of the world that have relatively high levels of natural radioactivity stemming from the uranium and thorium that's in the soil. Some parts of the world is very close to the surface, and this leads to extra radiation to the populations living there. And of course, you know, medical science has known for a long time that, you know, the second leading cause of lung cancer in the U.S. and in China is from the radon in the ground, which is a natural source of radioactivity. It leads to many thousands of extra deaths due to lung cancer in the U.S. every year because of this additional radiation source. But when you look at all the other animals for other kinds of characters in these naturally hot spots, many of them show consequences in terms of either genetic damage or other kinds of diseases as a direct consequence of the exposure to these very low levels in these naturally hot spots. So, yeah, this whole notion that a little bit of radioactivity extra radioactivity. You shouldn't worry about this. Again, it's all dependent upon how much little extra radioactivity. There's no such thing as extra mutagens being good for you.
Now, we've talked about the risk of forest fires in the Ukraine and its neighboring countries. What about the risk of forest fires in Japan after the Fukushima nuclear accident?
Well, that's one of the first things that comes to mind. We've been thinking a little bit about that. It's a different kind of environment. It's a more humid environment, and it's mostly montane. And so I really don't know what the potential fire hazards are in that environment currently. It's always a concern, especially where you've had years and years of forest management largely restricting fire from occurring. And so this leads to the accumulation of fuel on the surface layer that can be sparked by a bolt of lightning or a cigarette by a passerby, as seems to have been the case in Chernobyl this past week. And that can generate these very large fires. So yes, it is a significant concern for Japan, although I don't think anybody's really started to think about it just yet. But given what we found with respect to the accumulation of dead plant material in more radioactive areas, the fact that the radiation impedes the normal decomposition process, leading to higher accumulation of what is essentially fuel for a fire, this is a significant concern. We've just started experiments this past year in conjunction with some of our Japanese colleagues to see whether or not the same kind of accumulation of litter is happening in Japan in the more radioactive areas, and hopefully we'll have an answer to that by this fall.
Now, as we wrap up, is there anything that I've missed that you would like to leave with our listeners?
There's so much I could go into. So there are a couple of issues, broader issues, that are worth pointing out. And the first is that because of differing perspectives by different communities related to this topic, and by that I mean scientific and policy-making communities, there's really been very little investment into the sorts of basic research that our group has been doing, the basic ecology, genetics, and evolutionary biology that really has a large impact on the natural communities. So it's been largely ignored. And the second is that these nuclear accidents are not as rare as we used to think they were. There was a recent study published, highlighted by MIT, that suggested that nuclear accidents on the scale of Chernobyl are likely to occur in the coming years. You know, a 3-mile island scale accident is likely to occur in the next 10 years. You know, nuclear energy is not going away anytime soon, and so we really do need to know more, much more, about the potential consequences for both human health and the broader environmental impacts if we're going to continue down this path.
That's a great point. You know, after Chernobyl, we thought, well, that's it. We've learned it'll never happen again, and now we have Fukushima, and there have been a lot of near misses in between. Well, we've been talking with one of the most experienced scientists studying the impacts of radiation on living things. He's published over 160 papers, 2 books, and co-edits the annual work, The Year in Evolutionary Biology. Dr. Timothy Mousseau is a professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina. You can find links to his work and some of his interviews and presentations in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info. Tim, thank you for your continuing work and for talking with us today.
A pleasure.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Coming up, Dr. Tim Garrett and the awful truth about our fossil economy. Here is an unusual plot for a story. An atmospheric scientist uses principles of physics to predict the global economy may slow to near zero growth. Then its fragility and exposure to natural disasters suggest a high risk of accelerating collapse. That's part of an ongoing discussion I've followed over the years on Radio EcoShock with University of Utah scientist and associate professor Timothy J. Garrett. In 2 interviews in 2010, Tim Garrett explained his discovery of a formula that linked economic wealth to the amount of energy consumed. That sounds simple, maybe even obvious, but it caused a slight storm of criticism from old-school economists. Tim's work also predicts that only a precipitous crash in our economy could avoid a disastrous warming of up to 5 degrees Celsius by the year 2100. We've got lots to talk about. Tim has pursued his theories and observations in a two-part publication coming out in scientific journals in 2014 and March 2015. Tim Garrett, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be talking with you again.
You too. Let's orient new listeners to your work a bit. How can you apply the laws of physics to the ever-changing human economy?
Well, I think this is the interesting part, which is that in my own mind, I like to think that the universe is fundamentally really rather simple. I think that's a common attitude of physicists. We all like to look for simplicity and generality in how we describe things. Perhaps one way of thinking about it is that the universe probably can't be that intelligent. It can't come up with anything too complicated. There probably have to be some fundamental truths that apply everywhere. And when you think about it, we ourselves, the economy, the global economy, it's unavoidably part of the physical universe. And I think if one adopts that perspective, then one perhaps might start to think that perhaps then the global economy must follow fundamental physical laws. And if so, perhaps those rules are really rather simple rather than complicated, provided we take the right perspective. Perhaps if I can understand one aspect of physics, maybe something as simple as a growing snowflake, then maybe I can understand other aspects of the universe too with similar sorts of equations, perhaps even the global economy. And so that was a problem that I started thinking about and developing theories around, and most recently starting to test more rigorously to see if that perspective is indeed one that does seem to work.
Okay, now I've got a couple of general questions for you before we really look at the papers in detail. Can you explain for the layman the essence of your founding theory of the constant relationship between wealth and energy?
Yeah, sure. So there have been many discussions previously about the relationship between how much energy nations or the globe as a whole consumes and the gross domestic product, which is the most familiar measure of economic wealth. And these observations tend to point to economies getting more productive for a given amount of energy. Now, here's the thing, is that we can think about perhaps a person here as being a good analogy, as perhaps someone grows into their teenage years or even as a baby, they might get very productive at growing for a given amount of food consumption, which is energy consumption. These are the analogies I'm thinking of. So they go through growth spurts where they get much more productive, they accumulate more mass, they grow more quickly, and for a given amount of energy consumption, they're able to use that energy more efficiently in order to accumulate more mass. But then as they grow into adulthood, it seems that their growth more or less stops. Of course, this is something that most of us struggle with throughout our lives, but ideally we maintain a stable weight. Does that mean we stop consuming energy? No, not at all. In fact, even though we are no longer growing, we are constantly consuming energy just to keep ourselves alive. And what this means is that there are circulations within our body, circulations of blood, circulations of electrical signals, or whatever it is, that must constantly be sustained through a consumption and dissipation of energy. We eat food, the food drives the motions throughout our body, and then we radiate heat. And so I started thinking, well, maybe there's something similar for the global economy, that maybe aside from the production, there is another quantity, one that I might think of as being wealth rather than production, how much we have, like our weight, how much we are able to do through all our circulations, going back and forth from work, doing Google searches or whatever it is. And this requires a continuous consumption of energy. So this is a rather abstract idea, but it's one that actually turns out to be very well supported by available statistics. If we think of wealth in terms of dollars rather than GDP, which is dollars per time, then it turns out that there's a fixed relationship between civilization's wealth and the amount of energy it consumes. Right now, our total wealth turns out to be about $2,000 trillion. And our rate of energy consumption is about 17.5 terawatts. So this is continual energy consumption, about, 17,000 large power plants, whether they're coal or nuclear. So that sustains all our wealth. Back in 1970, both quantities were about precisely half that. And in between, both wealth and energy consumption have grown in lockstep. So a heavier person needs to consume more energy to sustain themselves than a smaller person. A larger civilization needs more energy to sustain itself than a smaller civilization. And it turns out that this relationship is very tight. It's basically a fixed relationship, as it turns out, of about 7 watts per 1,000 inflation-adjusted 2005 U.S. dollars.
Now, let's look at two of your recent papers in detail. The first is titled Long-Run Evolution of the Global Economy, Number 1, Physical Basis. It was published in Earth's Future, an open journal of the American Geophysical Union, on March 4, 2014. You point out that economists seem to see a different world than physicists or biologists. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think that the economists are perhaps more driven by trying to influence policy and are more focused on people as active agents in political change and in economic change. Whereas for a physicist, it's more natural to think of the system as a whole, irrespective of whether it's people or cars or anything else. We're all energy-consuming agents that transport matter to and fro. So I think when they were looking at my work, a lot of their criticisms were based on them coming from a very different perspective. So I think a difference of philosophy as much as anything. And in many cases, that led them to misinterpret what I was saying. A common criticism was to say that there is no fixed relationship between wealth and energy consumption because clearly the GDP is becoming more productive as we consume more energy. And I would agree with them. However, that was not what I was saying. I was saying rather that wealth, not the GDP, has a fixed relationship to energy consumption. I think, it's a common problem that people who come from different backgrounds have a difficult time appreciating what others are saying.
As you know, there's been a school of people warning the Earth has physical limitations that will rearrange the economy eventually. For example, Richard Heinberg writes about peak supplies of everything from fossil fuels to metals. How does your work relate to that movement?
Well, you see, this is the great thing, which is when we are able to link the economy to a physical quantity like energy consumption and show that there's a fixed relationship between an economic quantity and a physical quantity, then we can start thinking about the economy as being basically a rather simple physics problem. Now, when I say a rather simple physics problem, perhaps physics problems don't seem that simple, but nonetheless, there are very simple ideas that apply. And you can imagine quite easily, I think, that if we discover new sources of energy, perhaps new sources of oil, as we currently are doing in Alberta and North Dakota, then this is a force that will be applied on the economy that will allow it to grow faster. It's like going to the buffet too many times. If we go to a buffet where there are large amounts of food, it's going to be very difficult to maintain a fixed weight. There's lots of easily available nutrition that will allow us to grow faster. And we can formalize this using equations from physics and start thinking about what relative rates of energy reserve discovery and depletion mean for the future of the economy. And I think there's two sides to this coin. One is that discovering new energy reserves is great, but it allows us to grow faster. But the other side is that as we grow faster, we will tend to need to consume more, just like a heavier person. And as we need to consume more just to sustain what we have, we will deplete those reserves ever faster as well. So we have to discover new reserves at an ever faster rate just to sustain our newly enlarged in size. And then the other thing, too, is that the types of fossil energy supplies that we rely on are also ones that are associated with carbon dioxide emissions. And there we are seeing that carbon dioxide is accumulating in the atmosphere, and it's not hard to imagine that eventually perhaps even currently, carbon dioxide concentrations will get high enough that the climate starts to change in a way that starts to damage the economy and perhaps slow its growth.
So more fossil fuels might actually lead to something that damages the whole economy. But you've said that beyond mere energy, the way a civilization innovates to use energy is also important. Does that imply we could innovate ourselves out of the problems we face now?
It would be nice to think so. However, let's consider this. How did we get to our current stage where we are now extremely concerned about global climate change? We got to this point by developing a civilization that is massively consumptive and emissive of carbon dioxide by way of past innovations. It is our past innovations that have enabled us to grow ever faster so that today we are emitting carbon dioxide at a rate that is much higher even than it was even 20 or 30 years ago. It is our innovations that are allowing us to grow faster. It is our creativity and our access, ever-enlarging access to new energy supplies that is enabling us to grow, but also to pollute. So there are two sides to the coin of innovation. Innovation accelerates growth, but ultimately it may lead to decelerated growth through things like global climate change.
There's no such thing as a free lunch.
No, there isn't. The scientific words we use are positive and negative feedbacks. And one thing I like to think of is that any time one thinks of positive feedbacks, one must also ask what the associated negative feedbacks will be, because nothing grows forever.
And you also write about a fraying of civilization networks due to natural disasters. That seems obvious to me when I think about the repeated costs of things like Hurricane Sandy, made worse over and over by rising seas. Yet Wall Street and major corporations seem oblivious to all that. I wonder how long we can continue to ignore that cost.
Yeah, I wonder too. And I think that's an excellent question. In my own studies, it appears that the fraying that is going on, this destruction of civilization networks due to, let's say, environmental disasters, is locally very serious at times. I mean, just think of Hurricane Katrina. But the global effect remains relatively small. In other words, we are able to overcome this fraying by discovering new energy resources in sufficiently quickly that the fraying is a relatively minor issue at global scales. There may be natural disasters, but people can come from outside to help reestablish an economy at that local place. However, in the long run, you could imagine that there are two things that might happen so that the fraying might become a larger part of the equation. It may be that A, we don't discover new energy resources sufficiently quickly in the future, so that makes it more difficult to grow. And then you could imagine that the environmental disasters, too, also become more and more frequent, perhaps with global climate change and other issues, so that eventually the fraying and the forces of fraying and the forces for growth come closer and closer together. At some point, it may even be that we just struggle just to keep pace, and so that the natural disasters are sufficiently rapid that we are no longer able to grow. We only just tread water. And it's at that point that the modeling work I do suggests that civilization will become fragile and that perhaps some future natural disaster will lead us perhaps to a point of an accelerating collapse. And I think the model I have in mind here is a question of how will the growth end? The image I have in my mind is one of ocean waves. So you can imagine there are ocean waves that go up, they rise, and then they come down rather slowly, perhaps to rise again in the future. And those waves tend not to be particularly large. Then there are also the waves that grow extremely rapidly, perhaps because there's some source of energy pushing them upwards, let's say the rising of a seabed as it approaches the shore, And you see that wave rising very quickly as it approaches the shore. But then when the seabed stops rising, or it reaches the edge of the ocean, it runs out of energy, and then the wave crashes. So there are two possible options here, one of a slow decline and one of a collapse. And it looks like we might be headed more towards a mode of collapse in the future rather than a slow decline, simply because we have grown so rapidly in the recent past. Since 1950, we've gone through a period of absolutely explosive growth in population and energy consumption. And it seems like that's the sort of mode of growth that precedes collapse rather than a more gradual decline. And then I think the question becomes, well, if that's the case, what would that look like and when might that happen?
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with University of Utah atmospheric scientist Tim Garrett. Let's turn to the second paper in your series, Long Run Evolution of the Global Economy. Part two is titled Hindcasts of Innovation and Growth. Why the word hindcast? I'm missing that.
So in the atmospheric sciences, we create weather models. And the job of weather forecasters is really to predict the future. And they have a very complicated dynamic system, much like the economy. It's extremely complicated. Yet we are tasked to make forecasts using models based on physics that hopefully give some fairly accurate idea of what kind of weather patterns will show up. And I thought, well, here I have created a physics-based model of this complicated system, the global economy. I should in no way ever trust it. I must test it to the greatest extent possible before I have any confidence in my ability to forecast the future using this model. Now, in the atmospheric sciences, when forecasters use a weather model, the way they test it is they start the model at some point in the past, a past that's already happened, and then they try to predict the present. And if their model does a good job at predicting present weather conditions, starting the model, let's say, 10 days ago, then they might have some faith in the model to predict the weather over timescales of perhaps 10 days. Now, the reality is 10 days is rather long, but perhaps maybe over 5 days it does a pretty good job. And they have this metric they call a skill score for deciding whether or not their model is doing a good job or not. And so they evaluate models accordingly. So what I did was the same thing with my little toy economics model based on physics, which is to start the model with conditions in 1960, where some hypothetical economic forecaster in 1960 knew rates of energy reserve discovery and some economic conditions in the 1950s, and then tried to make a forecast, a hindcast, really, of economic conditions and energy consumption in the period between the year 2000 and 2010. And so I ran the model to see how well that model would predict current conditions. And it turned out that the model actually does exceptionally well. Using the language of skill scores, the skill scores for rates of energy consumption growth and for GWP growth, the gross domestic product growth, were greater than 90% for the globe as a whole. Now, I can't imagine doing it successfully for countries, but for the globe as a whole, it managed to predict things very well.
Well, now, you have part of this game as an atmospheric scientist, and I'm wondering, we've got the new talks coming out in Paris at the end of this year. What does your work say about the climate predictions made by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change?
Well, they have their own models. So their models are extremely complicated. They will have perhaps hundreds of equations that try to look at things going on at incredibly wide range of scales. I mean, they're just looking at countries, economic sectors, people, industry. They're very complicated. And my intuition is the more complex a model is, the harder it is going to be to test it and also to trust it. Now, when I've compared my model against their models in the past, what I find is that their models tend to be very optimistic about how much the GDP is going to grow over the coming century. And they tend to be also overly optimistic about how little CO2 levels are going to rise. In fact, they seem to have us growing to an absolutely massive size without having to consume much energy to sustain that accumulation of wealth. Now, they would argue that efficiency gains would enable that to happen, and I think my own work shows that efficiency gains, in fact, do the opposite. It's like what I mentioned about innovation, that it is by becoming more efficient that we are able to grow faster and ultimately to consume more. You can think about what happens during puberty. There must be something that happens with efficiency in an adolescent's body that enables them to turn their food into body mass and at a much faster rate. There's a difference between a closed system and an open, emerging, dynamic system. I don't think they have the right perspective.
Well, that's serious because we've been counting on them to point a way out, but I think that a lot of our listeners have already concluded that the IPCC is too limited in its mandate. But we could talk about that, but I'd like to move on further into your own work. Could you explain what you mean by decay parameter?
So this is like it's just an expression of the frame. So the decay parameter is, well, just think of a tree. It's, you know, I like thinking of trees or snowflakes or something that is branched and has networks in it, because I think of civilization as being a lot like a tree, where we have these road networks and telecommunication networks and social networks that are these intertwined branches that are always spreading outwards. Now, you can think even in our social networks, you know, there is a decay parameter for social networks. You know, we do tend to lose contact with friends over time, but also we gain new friends. The decay parameter is really just a representation of how rapidly networks naturally tend to fall apart with time. So for civilization, a decay parameter might be just the natural decay of buildings due to rotting of wood or just things falling apart. But you could also imagine the decay parameter being influenced by things like natural disasters due to climate change. So if there's an increase in, say, droughts, then you might expect, as it is happening currently in California, that to have an economic consequence through a decay of, perhaps in their case, agricultural networks.
And you've also predicted growth will slow, perhaps stop at some point for purely physical reasons. And I wonder if the phenomenon of negative interest rates, where the savers have to pay the bank rather than the other way around, is that maybe a developing sign of what you're writing about?
Oh, gee, I've wondered about that myself. That is above my economic expertise to talk about. Yeah, I do have to be cautious here, because those are details of the economic financial system which I am not currently able to express with a physics-based model. Perhaps it's already there, and I just don't see it yet. It is a very interesting question, one I've wondered about. I mean, at what point do the banks stop becoming profitable? At what point does the financial system start to collapse? Is it the same point at which we are no longer able to grow? Or is it at some other point? It's an excellent question. It's one I would like to answer myself.
You've also said that knowing the rate of world population growth won't change the basic theory of what happens here on Earth. That's pretty counterintuitive. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think a very great many people like to think about we and our population as being the fundamental drivers of our growth in energy consumption and emissions of carbon dioxide, or our consumption of everything. My own perspective is that population is a bit of a red herring. Rather, the population grows as a response to a higher availability of energy resources. If we find something like, let's say, the Saudi oil fields in the 1950s, then we've kind of hit the lottery as a civilization. There's this massive new source of energy that we can use to create more of everything. We can create more buildings, we can create more roads, we can create more people too. Because we ourselves, just like roads and telecommunication networks, are all made of matter. We have to be made, and it takes energy and matter to produce us. just like it takes energy and matter to produce roads and buildings and wires and everything else. We ourselves are made of networks, networks of nervous connections, of pulmonary connections, and cardiovascular connections. So roads, us, telecommunications networks, we're all networks, and we all enable flows. So I think, you know, that's rather impersonal and perhaps a bit depressing to think of things that way. But I think, thinking objectively from a physical standpoint, there is no obvious reason to make a distinction between us and everything else in civilization.
Now, in the abstract for your latest paper, you suggest forecasting that what will happen in the rest of the century will be harder because, as I read it, the impulse of fossil fuels appears to have run its course. That leads to two questions for me. What makes you think that fossil fuel, the impulse from that, is over? And secondly, why does that make prediction harder?
When we found these huge reserves in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, it created this massive impulse. And I imagine that this massive impulse is a force to which we see ensuing response of civilization. Now, it seems that civilization has grown to such a point that our growth rate is stabilizing now. We've kind of adjusted to the impulse that existed about 60 years ago. In mathematics, when you have an impulse, it is easy to characterize a response, but it's not until the next impulse shows up that the path forward becomes particularly clear. As for the future, it may be that there is another impulse that is upon us now. I went to a conference recently that was a real eye-opener for me. A professor at Stanford, Adam Brandt, was showing work suggesting that the amount of oil that is available in Alberta and North Dakota and elsewhere in North America in the tar sands is really quite massive, and it's not that expensive to get. So it may be that what North America is stumbling upon now is, again, another lottery that will lead to another phase of accelerating growth. That is difficult to predict without knowing precisely how much oil there is and how easy it will be to access. And I imagine that this is an area of research that many people will be focused on. What I think my work does is provide a framework for taking knowledge about how much we discover in terms of energy resources and using that information to make forecasts of where we might be headed as a civilization over the coming decades.
Tim, as a scientist with expertise on climate change, what do you think about the new warning from scientists in the Earth League that there is a 10% chance Earth could warm by an astonishing 6 degrees centigrade or 11 degrees Fahrenheit by the year 2100?
That sounds totally plausible to me. Part of the model predictions that I have done suggests that if the global economy is able to sustain itself, let's say we do discover sufficient energy resources, as perhaps we are doing quite right now, then we are going to emit a massive amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. It is in the model, it is not at all implausible to imagine the carbon dioxide levels passing 1,000 parts per million. That's four times pre-industrial levels. And four times pre-industrial levels would correspond to two CO2 doublings, which would translate quite easily to 6 degrees Celsius of warming. And that's where you start thinking about, well, the title of one of my papers, maybe really there's no way out. I mean, if civilization doesn't collapse because we run out of energy, then perhaps civilization keeps growing for a while, but the carbon dioxide emissions accumulate in the atmosphere to such a point that there is this warming that you talk about. And then you do have to think about what the implications are for civilization. And again, the word collapse does come to mind.
I suppose the next step for you will be to answer the critics of your new work and refine the theory further. I'd love to see a popular press book taking this out further, at least outside academic circles. Do you see that as a possibility?
Yes, it crosses my mind. Yeah, it's there are many pressures in academic life, but that is one that perhaps I should put further to the forefront if a sabbatical year comes up soon.
I'd love to see it. We've been speaking with Timothy J. Garrett, Associate Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. He's published a series of papers which show the economy cannot evade basic laws of physics, no matter what they tell you. Find links to Tim's latest work, his continuing series, and his two previous Radio EcoShock interviews in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Tim Garrett, thank you so much for talking with us again.
Thank you very much, Alec.
We've just squeaked under the clock. Find links and detailed notes on both of today's guests in my weekly show blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. I'm Alec Smith. Thank you for listening, and please join me again next week.